This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.vgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And this week, as we're talking about travel, Congress is out having fun. We've all heard about Bo and his ride in the V-22 Osprey having fun. The president's out golfing and such. Let's talk a little bit about the fun that we're having versus the price the environment may be paying a little bit down the road. Came across an article which the title alone struck my fancy, so I knew you would like it. Air travel is worse than a Hummer with wings. Its author, Megan McArdle, is here with me today. Hey, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm staying put this summer, being good for the environment.
So you're taking a page out of Christine Ashwanden's book, basically?
Well, actually, I should confess, we're staying put because we didn't really have time to go on an air travel vacation. I was really intrigued to read this article by Christine Ashwanden, who says she didn't go anywhere by air for a year because she realized just how bad it was for the environment. And so she gave up travel and stayed home and discovered the joys of staycationing rather than going to far-flung locales.
So this is interesting because even as I'm reading the article, and you bring it up a little bit later on in the piece itself, outside of Christine's portion, no one really thinks about what air travel is doing. I mean, we're here in the path of National Airport. I live near BWI. We've got so many rules and regulations around emissions on vehicles. I just took a car in for an emissions test recently. I see planes flying overhead all day long. Every couple of minutes, another one's landing. Really bad.
Much worse than driving for most people who are at least like you and me, working right. As urban professionals, living somewhere where you're not commuting an hour and a half every day. Actually, one transcontinental plane flight in an economy seat is the equivalent of driving a mid-sized sedan about 7,500 miles a year.
And we're talking about tons of carbon dioxide being released.
It's not just carbon dioxide, actually. That's part of it, but it's also it's where the emissions happen. So it isn't just the CO2. It's also the water trails, those vapor trails that you see when planes go by overhead. It's ozone. And because it's happening high up in the atmosphere, the effect is more powerful than emissions that happen here on the ground.
Ah, super greenhouse effect. What's the big deal?
Well, I don't know about you, but I find Washington already quite hot enough in the summer.
That's a good point.
We don't need any more mosquitoes in our backyard.
You know, you don't think about things like that.
Exactly.
You start turning it into a rainforest. I
mean, yes, we're going to basically turn D.C. back into a swampy rainforest if we're not careful.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I find interesting is not to have that same old argument about whether global warming is happening and whether we should stop it, but that people who do agree that it's happening and do think that we should do something about it, somehow they take plane travel out of the calculation, right? They talk a lot about having a small car or no car. They live in a smaller house. They like an urban, walkable neighborhood.
They even give you tax credits for buying that hybrid vehicle.
Exactly.
Like that, making it more appealing.
How many people do you know who own a Prius and then go on European vacations, right?
Probably all of them.
Exactly. And a European vacation is much worse for the environment than the extra emissions that you saved by buying the Prius.
So you made a clear distinction a little while ago, and I wanted to get back to that with regard to a coach seat. Coach seat versus first class. So me buying an extra first class seat just to put my bag on is bad.
Yes, it is worse than just having a coach seat. Basically, if you think of, you've got this big plane, it's made of aluminum, it weighs a lot. Neither you nor I could probably lift it with one hand,
sure.
Or even two. And so you have to allocate the weight of that plane per passenger.
Sure.
And so if you're in a coach seat, you get a little bit of the plane. But if you're in a first class seat where you're taking up two and a half times as much space, you have more weight of the plane to move through the sky than you do if you're way back in cattle class.
Cattle class. I like that. So, and I do this all the time. I think about emissions. I won't say I do. I think about emissions all the time. But you're behind that older vehicle. Occasionally, you see the older ones out there on the road and go, wow, it's got the historic tags. I'm like, that's great. Wow, that's doing a wonder for the environment. Are they? I mean, you see that old Chevelle SS or right. the really old Toyota Celica, which kudos for them for still running. But
well, the old Toyota Celicas, I think that those things ran on like you just sort of they're like the Flintstones cars, right? Sure. You just stick your feet at the bottom and run. But yeah, the old giant gas guzzlers, those beautiful vintage cars that you see right. from the 50s, they're beautiful, but they burn a lot of gas. On the other hand, at this point, there are so few of them around
right.
that it hardly seems worth banning them for the added emissions. The real issues are the things that we all do every day. It's going on those long distance trips and it's driving, you know, a large SUV with us as the only passenger. Right. Those are the real things.
It's more comfortable that way, though. I'm just
saying. Exactly. Very spacious.
You don't hear any complaints from the back seat. You got nothing going on. But in comparison to the vehicles, you don't see very many of those really old relic-like vehicles on the road. But the fleet of planes that are flying today are about that age.
And getting bigger.
And older. And getting bigger, exactly.
And those fleets are getting bigger because air travel is getting more and more popular. And it's easy to understand why, right? I mean, who doesn't want to go to exotic Turkey or honeymoon in Thailand?
Right.
But the problem with that is that honeymooning in Thailand is basically as if you guys had each bought a new midsize sedan and driven it around for a year.
Wow.
That's a lot of emissions.
That really puts it into perspective. But I have a feeling that there's not much. I mean, as much as I would like to say something will happen with this, I think there's a business reason behind why people are taking air travel out of the mix.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a sort of personal reason about it. We all like to advocate policies that are lower cost for us,
sure.
right? And so when I talk about carbon emissions, that's really easy for me. I live in the middle of the District of Columbia. I drive a Mini. I've owned my Mini for 5 years, and I have put about 8,000 miles on it.
Oh my gosh, really?
I wish your viewers could see the look on your face when I said that, right? Well, I grew up in Manhattan, and so even having a car but you know, for example, my husband grew up in North Florida, and our attitudes towards things are completely different. I view it as kind of shameful to go out and drive and get your groceries if they're small enough to carry. He thinks it's ridiculous to do anything except drive.
I'm kind of on his side here.
Right, yeah. This is everyone, you know, it's absolutely cultural for me. So my car is driven less than most people's. But so advocating greenhouse gas control for me is really low cost, right? It's practically no problem for me at all. But for someone who lives in a rural area, may have 3 kids, you got to get car seats for all those kids in there. And then maybe you're hauling brush on the weekends, you know, a giant pickup truck starts to look a lot more attractive. And so I think that what people are doing is they're psychologically taking out this big cost for themselves, because the people who advocate for global warming controls, by and large, are people for whom the part where you have to get a smaller car and drive less is not very costly. But for the part where you think, I would have to give up going to all my conferences and my business trips, and I would never get to vacation in Greece or visit my friends in San Francisco and all of that wonderful sourdough bread and Napa Valley, that starts to seem a lot more costly. And I think that tells you a lot about how the debate over global warming has proceeded in the United States.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Megan McArdle, author of the recent Bloomberg View article, Air Travel is Worse Than a Hummer with Wings. The title alone will grab you. Where are we going with this? What's next? Is the airline industry going to be tasked with making changes? Are we going to have to find an emissions station to roll these things into and shove the little probe in the back to see what's coming out?
Well, you know, I think it's complicated because unlike cars, so with a car, it really is feasible to have an electric car. It may not be desirable. And many people will be saying, no, I don't want to have to plug my car in.
You know what? I live out in Maryland. I live out in Anne Arundel County,
right.
Maryland, and I normally take the Mark Rail in and then Metro and such. And it only takes me a couple of minutes to get to the actual train station from my house. But when I do drive in, I'm normally in that big SUV all by myself.
Yeah.
And I look around and I see all the other big SUVs. It's easier for us.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the irony is that an electric car would be perfect for someone like me, except for one thing, which is that I live in an old row house in the historic District of Columbia, and I have nowhere to plug it in. But, you know, these are things you can picture fixes for them. You can picture more electrics, more hybrids, smaller cars the way they do in Europe. What you can't picture is a way to make air travel vastly more efficient because you actually, the energy density of hydrocarbons is such that we're pretty much only going to be able to get an airplane off the ground using either oil or some kind of synthetic oil that we've made that, right. that pretty much has the same properties, which means that getting rid of those carbon emissions is going to be really difficult. So I'm not sure that I see a big change on this front because the government likes regulations that at least appear low cost, right? You do CAFE standards, maybe this raises the average price of a car, but that's pretty invisible. But you slap a big fuel tax on airlines and people are going to scream to Washington and those screams will be heard.
Those Dreamliners are already having battery problems. Can you imagine the size of a battery it would take to get a plane off the ground?
Well, it would be so heavy that the plane actually wouldn't fly. Yeah, so yeah. I'm told that that will never happen.
Really long extension cords, maybe.
Yes, very much. Absolutely. Your mom's waving at you as you go overhead.
The article is called Air Travel is Worse Than a Hummer with Wings. Megan McArdle is her name. She's a writer with Bloomberg View. But she's also a writer in her own personal sense as well. Megan, you got a book coming.
I do. My first book. It's like your first baby, but it takes much longer.
Tell me more. Look, I've got my hands on my chin on my hands. Tell me more. Tell me more.
So it is a book about failure and recovery from failure. You know, every time I tell people this, they ask me, well, why would you write a book about failure? It's such a downer. And, you know, the real answer is that every you know, grade school writing teacher tells you write what you know. And this is... This is what I know about a lot.
Megan, do you want to talk about this? Really?
No, it's great. The book is actually, it started with that. It started with the fact I was unemployed for 2 years after business school and then ended up as a journalist, which was not what I had been planning when I went to business school, but actually turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. And so here's the interesting thing is when you Google best thing that ever happened to me, actually, the first thing you get is a Gladys Knight song. But after that, what's really interesting is that the things that you would think are the best things that ever happened to you, you getting married, the birth of your first child, those often are. People do say best thing ever happened to me. But then you know what the other things, even higher up than child and spouse, getting divorced, getting fired, getting paralyzed. you wouldn't think having
really?
Terrible accidents. Yeah, hitting bottom as an alcoholic. And what it turns out is that failure is this incredible moment of transformation. And this is not just true for people. Although we all, if we look back on this, we know this, right? You look back on the things that you learn the most from, and it's usually the things that were the hardest
right.
and the worst. And I'm not saying that they're not bad. They're really terrible. Being unemployed for 2 years was really awful. But it freed me to explore stuff that I never would have explored, including writing. Writing about business and economics, which is what I now do for a living, and which I love so much more
right.
than the management consulting job I was supposed to have getting out of business school. No offense to management consultants out there.
None taken, I'm sure.
So it's actually this moment of transformation. It's this incredible learning opportunity if you can take it. And so what the book is about is actually how do you take it? Once we all talk about in America creative destruction, the invisible hand of the marketplace, we let things fail and that's why America is great. And that's true, but it's not enough. It also really matters what happens afterwards. And so the book is about everything from personally, how do you pick yourself up and actually, you know, use that as a learning opportunity rather than as an opportunity to feel really terrible for the rest of your life and let the pain devour you, as one of the experts I interviewed said. But also, how does a company use failure and how does a company help its employees learn from failure and recover from failure? And we've got companies in the book who talk about having slots on their performance review where they say, you haven't failed enough. That was your biggest problem, that you did not have enough failures.
Sorry, because, you were too good this year.
Well, no, because what that's telling them is you didn't take enough risks, you weren't learning enough,
point.
You weren't growing. And all the way up to government, how do you have good government policy that allows things to fail and recover and put people back to work? And so it's everything from unemployment to bankruptcy to prison. How do, you know, innovative prison reforms that are teaching people how to get back on their feet and take that and turn their lives around. What's the best way to do that? And it was a really exciting book to write and hopefully a really exciting book for people to read.
People can't see the look on your face right now. As you mentioned my look earlier, your face is glowing just as you talk about this. So I can tell you're really passionate about it and I'm looking forward to it releasing, as I'm sure you are as well.
Me too. Upside of Down, coming out from Viking in February of 2014.
Looking forward to it. Her name is Megan McArdle. air travel is worse than a Hummer with wings. She's with Bloomberg View, and she's also a writer in her own sense. Megan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
To learn more about Bloomberg Government, simply call us at 877-498-3587. Bloomberg Government.
Bloomberg Government.
Where business and politics come together. Bloomberg Government senior transportation analyst Matthew Hummer has noted as a boost in security spending as the result of a border surge. Matt, thanks for being here.
Alan, great to be here.
Immigration, obviously a hot topic. All the talk of added security and measures to protect the border. And now we're dealing with a sequester at the same time, kind of in the midst of it. What has that done to the efforts? And what is Congress doing about changing the path that we're currently traveling on?
Well, basically, by introducing this amendment, it's a boon to defense contractors. While they were facing the sequestration cuts, this amendment actually provides $46.3 billion for defense contractors. And a lot of that would go to technology, surveillance equipment, and security equipment that these contractors provided in the Iraq and Afghanistan war. A lot of these technologies and devices will be used to actually secure the border. Something like almost 6,000 ground sensors made by Harris Corporation, Northrop Grumman, Textron, those type of companies that make these equipment.
Over the next 10 years, we're talking about this happening over the next 10 years. Is that the maximum amount of time that this amendment will cover?
That's right. The money will be available for at least 10 years, mm-hmm. and that's the time frame by which it should be spent. However, the amendment calls for implementing this security strategy a lot sooner because it is quote-unquote referred to by a lot of politicians as the trigger to start the path to citizenship, which is for the 11 million undocumented in this country.
So you've got a really cool chart in here that outlines exactly what percentage of the funds is going to go to what and over how many years it'll take or the funding will be available. We're looking at border surge boosts security spending 82%, a BGov insight by senior transportation analyst Matthew Hummer, available now on BGov.com. Border patrol agents, obviously 10 years. You're going to need them for the entire length of this particular amendment. Fencing strategy, that struck me as interesting, as we're only looking at 5 years. Are they looking, the companies that they're looking to build these are pretty confident in the structures that they're going to assemble? Is that what we're talking about?
That's right. And you know what? They tried this before. They've built about 350 miles already, mm-hmm. And some companies that really benefited from that was Granite Construction, Kiewit Corporation, Tetra Tech. All these companies made money off the previous, which they spent about $2.4 billion. Now they're calling for spending about triple that to build at least another 350 miles. So altogether, about 700 miles between the U.S.-Mexican border. It's going to be kind of a boon for these construction builders.
Strategy implementation taking about 9.7%. Something that I'm not quite sure of, meeting border security outcomes. How is that defined, and what metrics are they going to use to track that? Because that's, you're looking at a 10-year, using up 10 years worth of money.
That's right. And this pot of money is set aside for the commission that's supposed to include government people, local stakeholders that are supposed to assess whether or not this strategy of security is actually working. And so they're going to use measurement outcomes. They haven't drafted what those are, but the idea is to ensure that they actually have an effective control over the primary core areas of the border where they know most of the legal actually pass through. And so they'll use that money to beef up those areas, use more technology, use more fencing, whatever they need to do to achieve those outcomes.
Implementation funds for State Department makes sense. E-Verify, talking about using technology to move towards a better policing of our borders, so to speak. CSC is going to be a big winner. Microsoft as well. In the past, who are these are the same companies that they, the incumbents, so to speak?
That's right. You know, in my estimation, you would think so. So in the last fiscal year, about $69 million was spent to roll out this plan to only about 7% of companies in the U.S. So this legislation is calling for rolling it out to all companies in the U.S. So if you think about it, while there's a lot of fixed costs setting up this database, which Computer Science Technology Corporation actually got the main contract, about $42 billion to set up this database. That will likely grow, and they'll likely get more work. Along with Microsoft, they got about $18 million last year, so that they could continue with their awards. And you know, who knows what other companies could enter the arena on that.
Implementation funds for other agencies rounds out funds available for 2 years. We're talking about other agencies involved in the law enforcement or policing of the border. Is that what that's for?
That's correct. You know, you got to think about the USDA and some other agencies that coordinate with the State Department and Department of Homeland Security to implement this security strategy.
So along with E-Verify, we're talking about surveillance technology as well, which I found kind of interesting. That surveillance technology could include 15 Black Hawk helicopters.
That's correct.
That's pretty cool, if you ask me.
That's correct. And 15, and then, you know, I think total there's about 40 helicopters that are actually specifically identified in the legislation, right, along with, I think it's 30 Marine vessels.
So this has all been laid out and negotiated by Senator Bob Corker and John Hoeven of North Dakota. Do you envision full-scale Republican support around this?
Well, Alan, I think that that was the idea. They introduced this amendment to really surge and provide and meet the demands of a lot of the House Republicans and other Republicans in the Senate that were calling for stricter border security. While they didn't go as far to say that all this has to be secure, the border has to be completely secure before the path to citizenship, mm-hmm, but by itemizing this, the material and items in the bill, gives it a little bit more teeth. And so some of the reactions so far in the House, it's interesting. Some of them are saying it's candy and it's too much. Others are saying it's not enough because they're not ensuring that the border is secure. They're just ensuring that money be spent.
Right.
So that's the difference, and we'll see how it plays out in the House.
Sounds like classic Republican versus Democrat to me.
You know it. You know it, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Matthew Hummer. He's the senior transportation analyst with Bloomberg Government, and we're discussing his insight. Border surge boosts security spending 82%. Clearly, that's happening. $43 billion, $43.6 billion, in fact, on the table. Contractors are going to be pretty happy. What's next? What are the next steps in this process?
Well, the ball is really in the House, their court, really. I mean, Boehner has said that he's not going to take up a bill that the House Republicans don't fully support. That's known as the Hastert rule. Mm-hmm. And so basically their strategy is they're going to pursue piecemeal legislation. They've already done stuff on visas. They're going to continue on border security, and they're going to have multiple pieces of legislation that will go to conference and ultimately be married with the Senate bill. Or, you know, if support for this issue deteriorates, they could do nothing. And, you know, as a strategist, a political strategist might say that they would position to work on other issues, maybe corporate tax reform in exchange for moving this bill forward. Or, you know, like I said, or they could try to take up the Senate bill, which the House said they won't do. So there's really three options.
This Hastert, unspoken rule, so to speak, 234, the majority of the 234 is what they need to push things forward. If they keep bumping into this hurdle, this Hastert rule hurdle, do you envision rules changing?
You know, Alan, it would be tough to see that rule change in this House and in this Congress.
It's tough to make any decisions in this House and in this Congress.
True that. I really think, though, if you look at this particular issue, it's very clear the way the Senate was able to get a bipartisan deal done, that the nation altogether is for moving this issue forward. But when it comes down to the House and the fact that they are, you know, adherent to their districts, right, it's a lot different of a beast down there. So we'll see. You know, we're all looking forward to it.
All right. Only time will tell. Matt, thanks for being here.
Sure, Alan. Happy to be here.
And with that, we put the wraps on yet another edition of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. Follow us on Twitter at BGov. Bloomberg Government has a television program. It's called Capital Gains, seen weekly immediately following Face the Nation on WUSA 9. Capital Gains, Sundays at 11:30. I'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.